Interview Adrian Laborde, January 12, 1974.
What do you think is the legacy that belongs in Louisiana politics?
There is no enduring legacy, in my judgment. I, along with everybody else who follows the political scene in Louisiana, used to think that there was, and there was until 25 years ago. There is no enduring legacy. At that time, there was a general feeling that the Longs had left, had put populism on the political map to stay, that forever there was going to be bifactionalism in Louisiana with the Longite regime, or whatever followed Longism, would be the liberal element within the Democratic Party in Louisiana. Liberal in terms of friends of the little man and welfare programs and that sort of thing. This is what made Longism, you know. But then you go back to 1950 or thereabouts and subsequent years, and that legacy isn't there. I mean, there is no longer a tangible Long faction in Louisiana politics. And if Huey Long's legacy, whether you call it populism or whatever, did not endure much beyond Long and his immediate colleagues. Well, even his immediate family, you can erase that, because take his son Russell, who is now a senior senator, as you know, from Louisiana. I think Russell's a smarter politician than Huey. In 1952, I think it was, one of Long's pals in Congress, the late Hale Boggs, decided to run for governor against at least one candidate very easily identifiable with the old Long faction. Russell publicly supported Hale Boggs. So if you're talking about a political legacy, there has been none except for a very short period. Maybe.
So who got elected that year?
1952, that was, I think, Earl. Let me count back. We've had so many two-term governors, but none consecutive. I think 52 was Earl Long. See, 56, Jimmy Davis. No, 60 Davis, 54, 52, 48. That must have been Robert Kennan, Judge Kennan. That's what it was. Then Earl came back and was reelected in 56.
So what was it? It was Kennan, Boggs, and... Carlos Spate?
Carlos Spate was the Long
candidate.
Yeah, Judge Spate. Now, there is, if you get away from the strictly political legacy, I think there'll be at least one other generation that will equate such basic things to the basic today. They were revolutionary in Huey's days. Free textbooks for the school kids in Louisiana, which is commonplace all over now, but Huey Long gave that to Louisiana. He gave the state a fairly good network of highways at a time when there were no good highways in the state. He started the charity hospital system, for good, bad, or worse, but he started it. And you'd be surprised at the younger generation who never knew Huey and were not here, or were not adults, at least at the time. This has been handed down from the followers of Huey and his supporters, so that you might call that a Long legacy. And to that extent, I think perhaps today, for somebody who is easily identifiable with the old Long machine, and I call it a machine advisedly, or to come along and run for office and try to revive that bifactionalism as we knew it then, I think it might be amazing at how many younger generation voters would line up with that faction. There's still some of it, but the political powers, and I mentioned the case of Russell back in Hale Boggs, that same election represented the Congressman Jimmy Morrison for the 6th District of Louisiana, who had been made politically by Huey and his people, also supported Hale. So the political pros backed away a long time ago, but there's still an element of rank and file voters that haven't given up. But I think Longism is a faction within the politics. Other than that, is dead. So to answer your question, there is no enduring legacy.
Except in, to some extent, terms of programs.
Well, yeah, but I mean, this is not... You might consider it a legacy if you weigh it against what was here when Huey Long came on the scene and what is here now. But then if you look elsewhere and see that similar programs, social programs, have come to pass elsewhere, where certainly Huey was not a factor, never was, never even known, perhaps, it might be a matter of timing rather than of personality. So do you credit Huey Long and his type of politics and government, or do you credit the coming along at the right time, at the right place? In other words, you could argue all day that no matter who had taken over the reins of government in Louisiana at the time, the same things might have come to pass. Of course, this is indeterminate, but even so, because it has happened at that time or shortly afterwards in other states, you really, to be objective, it's hard to credit Huey, as most people have credited him with all of those things.
In the last governor's race, did that election represent a shifting of power from the north to the south?
Yes and no. What it actually did, it just put the power where it really lay in Louisiana. Your population, your voting strength is from Red River South, from Alexandria South. And this is the first time that it has voted in some semblance of unity. The strength of South Louisiana coalesced when it has never done that before. All these North Louisiana governors we've been electing, including Big John McKitten for two terms, and before that, as far back as you can go until the turn of the century, unless you call Sam Jones of DeRidder, a South Louisianian, they were elected by the people of South Louisiana. This is the first time that the people of South Louisiana decided, apparently, let's vote for one of our own for governor.
Was Alexandria considered part of the South?
No, Alexandria is considered part of the North. It's really on the boundary. It's, by any gauge, you're sitting right here as if you were on the boundary between two foreign countries, but even between Egypt and Israel, there's that much difference. But Alexandria is considered more North Louisiana South, although its people, it's polyglot. It's got a pretty good mixture of South Louisiana and North Louisiana. You've got a lot of French Cajun influence here. You've got probably a larger percentage of Roman Catholics among your religious here than you have in any other North Louisiana city. So it's a mixture, but it's still Rapides Parish. Alexandria is a seat, county seat, parish seat. Always votes the way the rest of North Louisiana votes.
How do you characterize these two, you refer to them, different nations, the North and the South?
Well, I don't know by what barometer, what yardstick you want to use, but North Louisiana is waspish, always has been. South Louisiana is pretty heavily Latin flavored, as you know, especially Southwest Louisiana. A lot of French people, a lot of Catholic people, a lot of liberals, and I don't mean by the conventional term liberal conservative, but I mean people who like the good life. Not as straight-laced as North Louisiana. A lot of people, especially in North Louisiana, and some very intelligent people whose judgment is unquestioned, like to say that North Louisiana is conservative by the old political definition and South Louisiana is liberal. I can see no justification for that. The point they make there, I think, and very few would admit it, is that North Louisiana is more conservative on the old race issue. There's a lot more racism. There has been, let's put it that way, from here on north and here on south. At least it has been more overt, and this is the only way you can judge it. And this is probably one reason, incidentally, in my own judgment, what I have seen, that South Louisiana has always given a pretty substantial vote to some of these North Louisiana candidates, because invariably, in recent times they have made race an issue. McKitten beat Chep Morrison, who was a very popular mayor of New Orleans, as you know, ambassador to the OAS and all that. And McKitten beat him in 1964 on a race issue. See, Morrison had led several candidates, I forget what, I think six in the first Democratic primary. He almost got a majority of the vote in the first primary, but not quite. So he was in a runoff with McKitten, and McKitten, a lot of money available, got on television, radio, newspapers, and he made race the issue. The black vote had gone substantially to Morrison. So he, his battle cry, McKitten, was Hep Me, H-E-P, and this became, they called him Hep Me McKitten for a long time. Because of the blog vote. The blog vote is against me. You got to help me. And he got all of the racists and some of the middle road voters in South Louisiana on the race issue. He got them all in his corner, so he clobbered Chep Morrison in the runoff. To surprise a lot of people south of here, not to my surprise, because a week before the election, Chep sat in an old rocking chair in a den there. He'd come back from a trip in North Louisiana. And he slapped me on the leg, says, Avis, we're going to finally win one. And I looked at him like that. I says, Chep, I don't want to be the killjoy, but I says, you're not going to win. There were three of his friends with him there, and he almost fell off his rock. He said, you crazy. I said, hell, I've been here long enough. This is an observation post here, you know, watchtower. I said, unless you carry New Orleans by a very substantial margin and all of southwest Louisiana, French Louisiana, you're going to be defeated, because I said, from here on north, it's going to be the same old story. On election night, I was at the office, and the first precinct to report in was the county seat of LaSalle Parish, north of here, neighboring Winfield, Gina. There were 87 votes cast, as I recall, or thereabouts. And it was 85 for McKitten and 2 for Morrison. And I told the fella sitting next to me, I said, this is the first box, but it might as well be the last. It's only a question now of what the final figure will be. What I had predicted was happening. They just were not going to vote for South Louisiana, especially New Orleanian in this case, liberal Catholic, who had gotten the black vote in the first primary. Now, this black vote thing, as you know, this is not only southwide, but nationwide. In a lot of areas, and certainly in Louisiana, you can't be elected to state office without it. I don't see how you can. You'd have to get the white vote 100%. That's very difficult. If you curry the black vote, the minority vote, in a primary, and you don't win in that primary, the opposition makes an issue of it. And this is what happened with McKitten. This is what happened when Jimmy Davis defeated Chep Morrison before that. It was a race issue.
Is that era passed, or is that still a potent issue in a statewide election?
I don't think it's passed. I think it's a subsurface issue. We have made a tremendous amount of progress here as elsewhere in the South. As a matter of fact, I like to think that Louisiana has probably made more progress than some of the other old Deep South states. But it's still a smoldering subsurface issue. There are still thousands and thousands and thousands of people, middle-aged and older, who just won't end the Civil War. Let's face it.
Well, as time goes forward, let us say, and as the younger, well, as this middle and older generation today gets older and its influence becomes less, do you think the younger people coming into the electoral process are as concerned about race?
There is hope that they are not as concerned. Well, and it's not only because of the evanescence of one generation and the arrival of another one, because I think mass communications and advances in transportation, that sort of thing, advanced technology, has done more to erase the racial lines in this country than all the civil rights legislation in Congress. There's no question in my mind. So I say I'm hopeful that the young generation, some of them are still being taught, now this fellow's a nigger, don't associate with him. There's still some of that. by comparison with the era when I was coming up, there's not much of it. But by the same token, I remember what I used to hear when I was a kid in high school. In those days, vote buying was rampant. You know, there were the old paper ballots. It was very easy to buy votes, even of an intelligent voter. And my father was an old country bumpkin, but he was pretty shrewd, and he always liked to dabble in politics. He never ran for office, but he supported somebody openly and went around introducing him, the old country-style politics. And his candidate invariably would lose because he tried to run on his campaign. My father wouldn't back a crook. One day he had lost a race for sheriff, and he was very angry, and he told me, he said, me and my brother, he said, I'm going to give up. We can't elect an honest man, but this will change. When you boys grow up, the voters will all be educated. They will make independent judgments. They won't sell their votes. And the whole thing will change. It hasn't come to pass. The electorate as a whole is considerably more enlightened, but you'd hardly know it from some of our elections. But I think this thing is happening with respect to race. I think our younger generation are more enlightened, and enlightenment per se has brought about less bigotry, a broadening of the collective mind, and I think racism is on the way out. It's not gone by a long shot. It's still, a smoldering subsurface factor in politics in the South.
What do you think going to be the long-range political effect of school desegregation, the fact that voters, younger voters coming into the electoral process will have gone to school with people of other races?
Well,
whether black or white.
There again, I think overall there'll be greater tolerance both among blacks and whites, and therefore the racist angle in politics should almost disappear in the next 10 or 20 years. This is one positive, expectable positive result of school integration. On the other hand, there are still countless thousands, the percentage is probably anybody's guess, of young people whose parents, perhaps under other pretenses than just racism, have sent them to private schools rather than integrated public schools, or have told them, now you have to go to the school, this is where you were zoned, and this the law of the land that we've got to mix the blacks and the whites in school, but you're still white. There's still some of that. And whether this parental advice, negative though it might be, can predominate over the long haul, over the actual example and lessons in the schoolroom where these kids are together, only time can tell. But I think overall it's got to be a positive factor. It's got to eliminate or at least cause some moderation in the issue of racism in politics in the South. You find it that way in other states?
I think so.
Where are you from originally? I would say Louisiana is like two different countries, not two states, where this North Louisiana, South Louisiana, which you don't have. But from what I've, a little bit I've learned about South Carolina politics, there's a lot of similarity. I think you have these political accidents and opportunists and demagogues like Strom Thurmond. You're liable to have them in any state. He might be a great white father to you, but to me, he's just a political opportunist and a damn demagogue.
Another one?
I heard him in the flesh. They put him on the grill pretty good, but it looked like he had memorized all the answers, and if they asked him a question whose answer he had unmemorized, he was off track and he couldn't answer. So afterwards, I went chat with him a little bit, start talking about what he thought of Russell Vaughn and some of our old Louisianans up there. And hell, he couldn't make him make a firm statement to save your neck.
This was Strom?
Strom Thurmond. All he was doing was telling what a great guy Nixon was. Maybe Nixon is a great guy.
Do you see Gillis Long making any other attempts at statewide office?
I wouldn't try to figure out what Gillis might do. He's a political animal. He says he's not interested in anything but staying in Congress a little while this time. He made the mistake once of trying to get promoted too quick. Because, you know, one term, then he runs for governor and got clobbered. Ran for governor again last time. Of course, he was unemployed as far as politics was concerned. He didn't have much to lose, but he got beat again. And I think Gillis has the makings of a real good congressman. He's a smart fella, you know. I don't know how much you know him, but he's one of the smarter longs. Of course, they're all pretty shrewd. Gillis, like most of the other, a little bullheaded. You got to twist his arm several times before he feels it, but he's an awfully capable man. He ought to make us a real congressman. And I hope he stays there a while. A two-time loser, you take governor, for example. He's lost twice, and this is hard to come back, even though he is still relatively young. And I don't know what else he'd run for. Certainly he's not, I don't know who or when he could beat for U.S. Senator. So as I say, I think he ought to stay where he is if he can, and he'd make us a good one. We need people like Gillis Long, and some of his political enemies think he's great white liberal of the Humphrey type or something like that. I don't see that. I think he's pretty moderate, and he'll waver a little bit, and I think he ought to do that in public life. This business of trying to categorize somebody way left of political center, way right, I think is ridiculous, because I think the fellow that's way left, there are occasions when you come to center and maybe you owe the right of center, isn't that right? And the same thing for the fellow on the other side of the fulcrum. He'll move a little bit, and he should on issues. And I don't think Gillis is no great. I'd say he's a moderate. He's conservative on some things, as a matter of fact. But we need people like him, not only for Louisiana, but for the whole country to offset some of our radicals on both sides. And we've got him in Louisiana, too. I don't know if you're familiar with our delegation, but we've got this fellow Rarick from 6th District, Baton Rouge. And guy's not only a conservative, he's an ultra-radical, almost revolutionary. And old Passman, he's ultra-conservative on some things and just plain nothing on others. And he's a capable congressman, but I think Gillis is great in-between guy.
This changing racial attitude and so forth in Louisiana, what does that mean for a congressman like Rarick?
Well, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you view it, Rarick represents a district where he can polarize so-called conservative vote, or has been able to in the past, against the black and few white liberals that, hell, it's no contest. Except for the city of Baton Rouge, his district is fairly waspish, you know. And this is what makes it easy sailing for him. I thought last time that this fellow who is district attorney in Baton Rouge, I don't know the man personally, but he's got a pretty good reputation, been in public eye down there, O.C. Brown, I thought he'd give Rarick a fit, but he didn't do it. So maybe Rarick is just reflecting the collective philosophy of his constituents. I don't know. On the other hand, it's the old 8th district that Gillis represented, of course, has been changed so much. It goes way south now, and he's got a lot of this South Louisiana element. But the old 8th congressional district was about the same as Rarick's. I mean, it was waspish, and you had to be all out right, and you had to cuss all the liberal Democrats at every opportunity and cuss the niggers and everything else to get elected. So I don't think Gillis might not be in Congress today if they had reapportioned to give him some of this liberal South Louisiana territory. He's got a considerable amount of it.
Would it be fair to say that South Louisiana tends to be more tolerant? Not only on race, but on other things. And it's a general approach toward life.
Yeah. South Louisiana is where you have all of your pari-mutuel betting at the racetracks. You have open bingo games and saloons all over the place. And you name it, it's a different country altogether.
Would that extend
They're tolerant of everything.
Would that extend to political corruption?
It could very well, and I've seen this and heard it, that South Louisiana is more tolerant of corruption. They look the other way a little more. But I don't know that this is true. You'd have to weigh this against a lot of factors. You have to consider the relative population, for example. As I say, the population has moved south. North Louisiana, except for two or three cities, is now cut over timberland, and it's losing. A lot of our parishes north of here lose population every year. So as a percentage of your population, I don't think there's any more tolerance of corruption inside Louisiana. As a matter of fact, most of the hell raising about what erupts as corruption in public life has come from South Louisiana. There's not too many of these Bible Belt people in legislature or elsewhere that make a big to-do about when something is exposed. I think a lot of it comes from South Louisiana.
Well, do you think Louisiana politics tend to be more corrupt than that in the rest of the South, or is it only exposed more?
I have been accused of saying in print for years that this is true, that Louisiana has more than its share. It's difficult to say. I don't think it's exposed more. It has been in the last, since McKitten's second term in 68, in the last 5-6 years, there's been extra effort everywhere, on all fronts in Louisiana, from the federal courts on down, to expose more of it and stop it. And it's bearing fruit. Before that, I don't know. Maybe it's because we publicize it too much. We emphasize the negatives too much in Louisiana, but I think we get more notoriety from our corruption in public office in most states. One of the most prominent bankers around here chastised me in a letter some time ago. He sent me a clipping from the Wall Street Journal about some miscreancy, I think, at that time in Pennsylvania in state government. And this journal article mentioned some recent things in New Jersey. Of course, New Jersey is notorious too for bad pot. And several other states. And this banker said, look here, he said, Louisiana is not even mentioned among the most corrupt states. Why don't you lay off? Well, I can't buy that. I think we've had a lot of corruption. Maybe not more in the other states.
Governor McKitten said that there was a lot of charges of vote buying, vote stealing. Resulted in the move toward voting machines. He said they put in voting machines Erlong had election and won handily, won by as big a margin as anybody would have guessed him to win anyway. And that the charges themselves really were based on myth.
I don't buy that. Of course, vote buying has always occurred, and it's hard to prove. It's hard to catch anybody buying or selling a vote. You know, you'd have to have some.
Well, I don't think he was talking so much about buying as stealing.
Well, or stealing, the same thing. But you've got to conclude that it's easier to steal X number of votes or steal an election with the old paper ballots. Because all you needed really, and I was just a kid not voting in the early days of Longism. I did vote when you ran for office several times. I'm getting pretty old. When they could, the books are full of that stuff. Hell, they could keep out so many ballot boxes until they determined what they needed to win. But they could lose some. Some of them, I'm told, in, where is it, Jefferson Parish, they've never been found, some ballot boxes. And now this cannot happen with voting machines. I don't think they've ever lost forever any tally sheets off a voting machine. If they have, I've never heard of it. It's easier to steal an election or corrupt an election with paper ballots. And I'm sure this, as I recall, a lot of the pressure for voting machines was because of that. Of course, there's a lot of other advantages to voting machines, and I don't think anybody who's ever had them would want to go back. Is there any state not using voting machines nowadays? Mayor Downs was an unpaid assistant to McKitten for several years. He was his campaign manager.
Oh, that was the voting machine commission payoff.
He got $500,000 in commissions from the people who sold voting machines to the state. And he was indicted in federal grand jury. The state juries didn't bother him. And twice, thing ended in mistrials. His argument, his defense, and McKitten has stood by him, was that when he collected these fees, his commission, he was not a paid state employee. He was just a lobbyist or a salesman or whatever. This sort of thing. And I'm not trying to gig John McKitten. He and I have been personal friends. I've criticized him in print.
No, I
we're still personal friends.
No, I want you to help us put him in proper perspective.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, 6 months before John McKitten left office, when he was still having a lot of trouble, he followed me all the way to Baton Rouge at my daughter-in-law to beg me to go help him run his office for the last 6 months of his term. I thought he was kidding, you know. He said, no, I need you down here. Several times he's tried to get me to take a leave of absence from the paper and go do something for him, run some kind of department. And we've always been the best of friends. And maybe this is one reason, because he knows I'm not going to throw out any bullshit about him. I'm pretty candid about everybody, and if I think he did something wrong, I'm just allowed to say it in print. And if he does something right, I'll praise him. But he's got a habit of spouting off, you know, without too much. And I've told him that to his face, he ought to listen more and talk less. This got him into a lot of trouble. He almost resigned the governorship, you know, early in his second term, because he had gone to the Democratic, that famous convention in Chicago, where he really thought he was going to be a candidate for vice president, that he would be nominated for vice president on the Democratic ticket. And then I don't think anybody had that in mind except John McCain. Anyway, he left before the convention was over, and he came back a changed man, I thought. The change might have started before that. But he actually threatened to resign, and he wanted to resign. And his executive secretary called me and my publisher, Joe Smith, who he knew were but as close to McKinnon as anybody else in the media, to go down there and have breakfast with him and try to talk sense into him. And we spent a half a day there and told him that worst thing could happen to him and the state of Louisiana was for him to resign. We talked him out of it.
Why was he talking of resigning?
Because he said, I've had it up to here. I can't do anything with the legislature. The press is on me. The people don't believe in me no more. I'm going to turn it over to Tad Acock, who was then the lieutenant governor. And he was serious.
Who was his executive assistant at that time?
At that time was Ed Stagg, who was on loan from the Council for Better Louisiana, private non-political organization, but McKitten had run out of executive secretaries, and he borrowed Ed from Cable, CABL.
Are we going to see? He was really feeling down in April.
Was he down?
Was it directly result from the convention or just a reaction?
Well, this is when I detected it. Now, it might have started before that. He was getting a bad press before that. And like I told him at this long breakfast meeting in the mansion, I've never sipped so much cold coffee. A lot of it was his fault. He overreacted to certain things. You know, you're governor of a state under our system, you're going to be criticized. I don't give a damn how good you are. And you've got to learn to take it. He overreacted. He thought everybody was out to get him. And pretty much the condition the president was in, and perhaps still is, with the media in the East, especially with television networks. McKitten was convinced that the press in Louisiana was out to get him. But I didn't detect any real problem until after Chicago, when I found out he wanted to resign. And I thought it was a joke until I went down there, and it wasn't a damn joke. He was serious as he could be.
What were the things that had gotten him into trouble? Size of vice presidential business?
Well, really nothing of major consequence, just a lot of small things. There had already been these allegations, you know, about Sammy Downs. And of course, there was a famous Life magazine article about mafia running the Capitol. I'm sure you've heard of that.
Right. How do you evaluate that article?
Well, at that time, I thought there was perhaps a lot of substance to it. I never believed the mafia had much influence on state government, but a lot of the other things in there I thought were substantially based, until I got to know this chap a little better who wrote the thing, and he gets pretty wild sometimes. He sticks basically to facts, but you know the old story about stating facts two ways. You can say this guy spoke to an auditorium that was half full or half empty, you know, two different connotations. But aside from the mafia, I think David had a lot of facts about what was going on. Well, we developed that in this so-called mafia investigation that the legislature conducted. They found out all sorts of monkey business in such places as the Department of Revenue. My gosh, the state was looking the other way and collecting taxes from about 3/4 of the taxpayers and letting the others go scot-free. Some pretty big ones, too. It was a hit-and-miss thing. It was unbelievable.
Or was McKitten directly involved in any of that?
No, but these were McKitten's appointees that were running all these departments. I don't think McKitten was involved in this thing, but I do think McKitten, I've told him that to his face, knew more than he acknowledged in the things involving, for example, Sammy Downs. Now, Sammy Downs was the man in charge of the so-called black box, this little secret telephone in the governor's office that was in a black box and nobody could use but one. And that was Sammy Downs using that phone. Now, whether it was connected to the Mafia headquarters in New Orleans, Carlos Marcello or whatnot, I don't know. I'd never try to guess. But McKitten never said much about that little black box. And I think there were things going on that he knew about that he said he didn't know about. Well, it might have been hindsight, now we can say that. He might have been in a position with Nixon and people like Haldeman and Ehrlichman and whatnot.
McKitten to us just sort of dismissed the Marcello thing, and saying that there was one guy on his staff who was he had picked up, who was an alcoholic, who used to talk to Marcello, but that he had really never met the man, and that Marcello testified that the only time he'd ever met McKitten was once they shook hands when he was greeting a group of
that
people.
That could be true. I don't think McKitten, he's not that kind of man, would not knowingly have any truck with Marcello or any of those people. He's not that kind of man. I used to think that about Jimmy Davis, but you know, after Jimmy Davis left office, there were allegations that the Mafia had financed him substantially in his last campaign. So you never can tell. It's not any wonder to me who have been studying that stuff and writing about it and trying to evaluate and appraise it and make sense out of it for all of these years that now finally we see the evidence that public confidence and trust in politics and government is at rock bottom. It doesn't surprise me a bit.
Who headed up the Mafia investigation?
Oh, hell, I don't remember. I'd have to check our files on that.
But the fact that the guy who wrote that original story...
That was David Chandler who wrote that.
The fact that he later ran for governor, did that...
Oh, that was a joke, hell. I don't think...
Did that make his story less credible?
I don't think so. If he had really waged a campaign and gotten a substantial number of votes, there might have been some intertwining there. But the poor fellow didn't get any votes, hardly. And I don't think he made one campaign speech or bought one political ad or anything. He just got his name on the ballot, really. It was a damn joke. Some people accused him publicly of having written that article way back yonder with the idea it would help him politically, some political campaign. That's why he, in other words, he was building up a campaign for governor, but fizzle number one if that was the case. This Life magazine thing might have been unfair to the state. McKitten made a big to-do, but the fact remains, I'm sure you've heard this, he might have told you about it. He and some of his top aides flew to New York in a huff. They were going to tell the editors of Life magazine where to get off, you know, sue him. And as a matter of fact, he did sue Life for $10 million, never got a dime. And he came back from New York and said he's not going to do anything Life magazine because they knew things on us we didn't know, and they didn't print all they knew or something like that. So that's where that thing ended. It's a great game.
How do you assess McKitten's administration insofar as corruption is concerned, in him personally?
I don't think John was involved in any corruption personally of any magnitude. His first 4 years, his first term, and this is what hurts his image, his political record in Louisiana, is that damn second term, his first term. Everybody thought he was doing a great job. He was a good salesman, you know. He's a good front man. Number one salesman. As a matter of fact, when he wanted to resign, my publisher, Joe Smith, told me that. He said, John, you're probably the best salesman in this state, but you're probably the worst administrator in this state, or something to that effect. But he put on a good front. He'd go to New York and talk to his industrialists, got a lot of big payrolls in Louisiana, and did a lot of good things. Didn't get involved in any shenanigans until towards the end there. But as it turned out, John had surrounded himself with some pretty capable people. They weren't all Sammy Downses, and they were doing a good job. But then the chickens began to come home to roost after the Life magazine expose and his investigation, and it turned out some of the underlings weren't what they were cracked up to be, and it started hitting McKitten where it hurt. And he didn't have, as Joe said, he wasn't a strong enough administrator to straighten it out right away and keep it out of public view. And all hell broke loose. But I don't think John was a corrupt man. I still don't think he. I think he's basically an honest man, as honest as an 8-year governor can be. The temptations are terrific, you know. I'm sure you heard some of these stories, and I don't want them repeated or publicized, but when he made his trip to Europe, supposed to be in quest of industry towards the end of his term, and one of the standard jokes around the capital was that he left the party for two or three days, he took a side trip to Switzerland to deposit all that money in the Swiss bank, and he laughed at that sort of joke. I don't think he stole any money, I don't think he tried to, I think he was basically honest. I think most of our governors in Louisiana have been honest. As far as personal gain, they all come out in pretty good shape. I think they do in every state. You've never known the next governor to go on welfare or anything like that, or really have to work. They make connections, but I don't think any of our governors, including Hewitt didn't enrich himself directly. He set the stage to enrich himself, but the poor fellow didn't live to enjoy it, and some of his cronies got it. Jimmy Davis probably did better than anybody else, but then his friends would tell you he did it as a hillbilly recording artist, not as governor. Judge Kennan probably left office as poor as he went in. He was a country judge, and he's still trying to practice law. I don't think he's a wealthy man. Sam Jones was a fairly wealthy lawyer, whom I admire and still do. I don't think he left office with more than money. So even some of our governors that gave the state a fairly bad image, I think, were basically honest.
How do you evaluate Earl Long?
I think Earl was about the most honest of the Longs as far as personal gain was concerned. Earl didn't take a dime that didn't belong to him. I'm convinced of that. He and I didn't get along worth a damn, but I'm convinced of that. He was a boor and everything else, but as far as dishonest, no. Earl, if he did do something, get something under the table, it was to help somebody else, not to help Earl Long. That was one of his weaknesses. No, I think he's probably the most honest of all the Longs.
How do you evaluate the Edwards administration?
I think Edwards is doing a terrific job. Of course, I can't be very, I can't be unbiased, perhaps, because I was with him all the way, the personal friend of years standing, but I think he's doing a terrific job, and I wasn't surprised when he came out this week with a poll that showed 84% of the people in Louisiana thinking he's doing a good job. It's pretty damn high, almost halfway. He's made mistakes like everybody else. He's got some duds in his official family. I guess he'll get rid of some more. He's gotten rid of some one or two already. It's a hell of a job to be governor of a state, you know. You got to accept the responsibility for what so many others do. And you appoint people to responsible positions, assuming that they remember who gave them the job and try to keep him out of it, but that's not easy. It's not always possible. But I think for a man with the problems that Edwin has had, my gosh, man, you look, first of all, you're a freshman. His chair in the governor's office isn't warm yet. The senior senator from Louisiana dies 30 days before the primary. That's a hell of a headache for a governor. What to do? Call another election, let the other candidate be the nominee, appoint somebody for the interim term. You know what he did? He appointed his wife.
Another thing. How was that perceived by the public?
Amazing. There was no flack at all. None at all. Of course, you know, I don't know if you know our governor, but he's quick with a neat phrase. He's got a good explanation. He makes a joke of everything. Appointing his wife was the only way he wouldn't get half the people in Louisiana mad at him. If he appointed anybody else, he'd have that clique very happy. And the one he did not appoint, his gang would be mad, angry, want to tear him to pieces, couldn't win. He says, my wife, no problem. On top of that, he said he wanted to be sure whoever he appointed for the interim term was someone who would not run for a full term. And he says, I can't, somebody might tell me they won't run, but he says, I can't believe them, I can't trust them. My wife, I can, I'll see to it that she does not. So he got by. I was surprised. I expected the ceiling to cave in on him, really. Brand new governor appointing his wife as U.S. Senator.
Well, the net effect of that was ensure Bennett Johnson of the victory, wasn't it?
Well, no matter who he appointed, I think the way the thing developed.
Not the net effect of his appointment, but the net effect of the entire situation.
Well, the effect of Alan Ellender's death was that
right.
Bennett Johnson, who had the gall to oppose this old man, and nobody else would run against him while he was still alive, just happened to be the Democratic nominee by virtue of Ellender's death.
And there was no Republican nominee, am I correct?
No, I don't think there was. If there was, he must have pulled out. Yes, there was, too. I forget what it was, just a name on the ballot. Yeah, there was. Because there was a three-way general election, McKitten got in as an independent.
Right.
This hurt McKitten politically. It was McKitten and Johnston. Who the hell was this Republican?
Just token Republican.
Yeah, and McKitten, but McKitten did very poorly. Of course, he should have known that hell. In Louisiana, running as a third-party or independent candidate in a general election against a Democratic nominee. Bennett Johnson really took advantage.
Did he do himself any permanent political damage in running for the Senate?
Not in Louisiana. I think the IQ of the electorate in general is not that high. They don't pay that much attention to it.
Does he have any political future?
McKitten, I rather doubt it. He's got further ambition. He sent me word the other day by one of my reporters, I don't know if you're serious or not, that if I backed him for governor, he'd run next time against Edwards. And that would be a terrible mistake unless Edwards puts his foot in his mouth. I don't know, I'm afraid John is finished. State level, anyway.
Let me ask you this question about Edwards. I mean, after he appointed his wife,